has estimated that this year a minimum of 12 million young people in the United States will turn on, use marijuana for the first time. Some, as shown, will be infants, given the drug by their dope-taking parents. Others will get it in grammar school, often from older brothers or sisters. Many junior high school students will have smoked marijuana before they go on their first dates. Marijuana is a social disease, mainly affecting our youth. If no remedy is found, half of our young people may be so crippled by drug abuse within the next few years that they will never be able to function as effective members of society. Please reflect on that statement, because none of us can truly comprehend such a disaster. The insidious thing about marijuana is that the first time a youngster uses it, he may not experience much effect from the drug itself. Intoxication may be in the mind only because marijuana is cumulative. It builds up in the body, requiring up to 3 or even 6 exposures to the drug before full euphoria is felt. This cumulative effect has fooled many students and even so-called authorities who have tried the drug once or twice, found little effect, and reported it harmless. An illuminating example of such misleading research is given by Dr. William Lamers, a psychiatrist who personally experimented with marijuana and declared it to be a pleasant little drug, a mild sedative, slightly stimulating. However, a later encounter with a more potent brand of marijuana took Dr. Lamers through a terrifying 3 hours in which he thought someone was going to kill him. He experienced suicidal tendencies. A plane overhead signaled the start of World War III. Doomsday. Since that time, Dr. Lamers has treated as many as 8 people in 1 week for psychotic reactions to marijuana. He says that people who suggest legalizing marijuana simply don't know what they're talking about. There are 3 major interlocking factors that one must consider before evaluating any report on marijuana. Scientists call these factors the drug, the set, and the setting. The effects of marijuana on the smoker are difficult to describe or predict. They vary from person to person and even with the same person at different times. This variation occurs because the amount of cannabis, the intoxicant in marijuana, varies as to where it is grown and how it is cultivated, harvested, rolled, and smoked. This is the factor called the drug. The second factor, the set, is a user's expectations from the drug. When a person expects something to happen, he becomes set or psychologically ready for that thing to happen. And with drugs, this may actually help to cause the very effect which he expects. The setting is the environment in which the drug is used. Because of the interaction of these factors, a participant at a pot party is almost certain to obtain far greater effect from a joint of marijuana than would a skeptic in a laboratory test. Another factor is that these experiments have been conducted on adults, not children. Most young people are firmly convinced that marijuana is not very dangerous and definitely is not habit-forming. They have not been told by the news media that countries like Egypt, with extensive marijuana experience, imposed the death penalty for growth or sale of marijuana. Nor that in Morocco, 25% of male admissions to mental hospitals were for marijuana-induced psychoses. Nor that a 1964 UN bulletin characterized such psychoses as hallucinations, paranoia, and thought disorder similar to schizophrenia. The half-truth that marijuana is not physically addictive easily becomes the big lie that it is not habit-forming. Drugs may be habit-forming by either physical or psychological dependency. Heroin, shown here, causes both, for the body becomes extremely ill upon cold turkey withdrawal, and the mind continues to demand the drug-induced euphoria long after the physical symptoms have subsided. Psychological dependency is by far the more important, as is obvious from the fact that over 90% of cured heroin addicts return to drug abuse, and they will lie, steal, cheat, and even kill to continue their drug euphoria. Marijuana apparently does not cause any physical dependency. In fact, it doesn't even leave a hangover, but it does cause a strong psychological dependency. And even worse, it has a strong tendency to escalate to more powerful narcotics. It has been found that over 90% of heroin users started with marijuana. And the New York Social Services estimate that 40 to 50% of all teenage marijuana smokers will be on heroin within 18 months. There is no chemical explanation for the escalation to stronger narcotics, but there are psychological, sociological, and sexual explanations. The eminent professor, Hardin B. Jones, of Donner Lab at the University of California, best explains this. Most of the drugs that have ever been abused affect a person sexually, and it is through this vehicle of sexual stimulation that drugs exert their greatest addicting power. Marijuana is a mild aphrodisiac. It enhances the sexuality and makes a person more receptive to sexual stimuli. But this condition lasts only a short time, and chronic marijuana users find that sexual activity without the drug is difficult and confusing. Because hard drugs exist in the same circles of dealers and users of marijuana, there is the opportunity, example, and encouragement to transfer for the purpose of a better high. If the transfer is to amphetamines, the person becomes addicted with a single trial, because amphetamines induce a pre-orgasmic sexual response which is associated with the brain and not with the genital, and which will last as long as a person keeps taking the drug. Because of this autosexual excitation, a person will keep taking amphetamines until he is so sick that he has to interrupt his pre-orgasmic state. These large doses, often injected intravenously, lead to massive, irreparable brain damage for those who have been continuously on the drug for several days. With this knowledge of the pseudo-sex stimuli caused by drugs, it is possible for a normal person to have some understanding of psychological addiction. However, it must be emphasized that drugs cause a sexless, perverted sexual appetite and are the most powerful known destroyers of both sexual and mental health. Another result of 5 years of incomplete reporting and distortions by the news media is the firm conviction of most young people that marijuana is no worse than alcohol. No parent can justify the use of alcohol, so the news media has used this myth very effectively to set child against parent and create the so-called generation gap. In the U.S. alone, 100,000 young people, 2.5 times U.S. Vietnam War deaths, have been killed by drugs, and far more have been converted into mental cripples. Here is a victim of LSD. The media created the hippie movement in this country, and the poor, unfortunate, burned-out children still living in areas like Haight-Ashbury are the product of drugs, not alcohol. This much-glorified teenage utopia was very short-lived because the news media not only attracted naive youngsters from all over the country, but they also attracted every possible form of human vulture. Criminals, perverts, and the mentally deranged came, flocking into San Francisco, attracted by reports of free sex and thousands of weaklings and freaky kids to pillage. Gang rapes were common. Killings multiplied as underworld types vied for the lucrative drug sales. Most girls finance their expensive drug habit by prostitution. Perhaps just a few years ago, this girl was on a hike with the Girl Scouts, or went on her first date, but at some time smoked her first marijuana cigarette. Haight-Ashbury, Telegraph Avenue, and all of the other hippie communities across the United States probably are best summed up by the underground press publication, Good Times, which shows some candid shots of burned-out teenagers on the streets of San Francisco. The terminology underneath talks in drug jargon of heroin, wine, despair, hopelessness, and sorrow. These run rampant in Haight-Ashbury. This is a typical example of degradation on drugs. One can understand how naive teenagers can be trapped into the drug problem. But what is difficult for most adults to understand is how the college student who has everything to lose, who is supposed to be the top intelligentsia of his age group, who can look forward to the most phenomenal society in the history of mankind, why does he become involved with drugs? The answer is quite simple. There are two factors involved: existentialism and the alienated personality. To understand this, we must turn to the free speech movement at Berkeley, where a young communist by the name of Bettina Aptheker, with approximately 500 followers, some of them students, achieved national recognition from the news media and thus introduced the New Left movement, which spread the use of marijuana to college students. Note, 27,000 students were enrolled at the University of California at Berkeley, and they allowed this handful of revolutionaries to take over their school. To see why this is significant to our drug problem, we refer again to Dr. Hardin Jones. The college student today believes that people do what people do, and there is no right or wrong. This has to be because they believe there is no God, and in the absence of any divine influence, all human beings are God, and as God, we can do no wrong. This, in a nutshell, is existentialism, and in one way or another, many students today have accepted parts of this. This is what allows 27,000 students to stand by while a handful of revolutionaries brings their university to a halt. This is what allows students to give social acceptance to other students who smoke hash in public, even though they are committing a felony. Drug abuse now causes 24% of admissions to USC Medical Center. The free speech movement gave recognition to acid rock music, music to be enjoyed under the influence of drugs. There were a number of semi-professional local San Francisco and Berkeley musical groups, like the Grateful Dead, Big Brother and the Holding Company, the Jefferson Airplane, Country Joe and the Fish, just to mention a few, who were shot into national prominence thanks to the recognition of the revolutionaries, the millions of dollars spent by major record companies to promote their records, and the free publicity given by the news media. This established the second factor causing college students to turn to drugs. It has been defined by experts as the alienated personality. The two men who have studied this alienation syndrome most extensively and expound upon it most articulately are Seymour Halleck, Director of Student Psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin, and Kenneth Keniston of Yale University, whose thesis, The Uncommitted Alienated Youth in American Society, is considered to be the best exposition of the problem. In summation, they say the alienated youth feels that American society is ugly, sordid, reprehensibly materialistic. Its values are dishonest, hypocritical, and dehumanizing. They repudiate anything which to them smacks of materialism or phoniness. Life is not happy. It is lonely, meaningless, and boring. They reject with disdain their families and virtually every facet of American society. They are detached from their colleagues and even from themselves. This is the alienated personality. The acid rock music, which predominates in the top 40 records sold to teenagers, is a study in promoting this alienated philosophy. This music, for the most part, is anti-American, anti-family, anti-free enterprise, anti-religion, pro-socialism, pro-sexual promiscuity, and pro-drugs. The great tragedy is the full acceptance and overwhelming popularity of this music, not by just a wild fringe group, but by the children of middle and upper middle class Americans, the basic elements of our civilization. Much of this music is now concentrated on FM radio, and it is broadcast by networks nationwide. For a broad course in subversion and incitement to delinquency, spend a few hours listening to such programs as Love on ABC stations or to the KMET Los Angeles Metromedia station. The youngster entering college today has been subjected to at least 5 years of this type of propaganda. Whether he realizes it or not, the constant repetition of this philosophy has the same impact on the subconscious mind as any advertising jingle. Only the advertising jingle sells billions of dollars of merchandise. This sells the philosophy of revolution. When a student reaches college after years of this preconditioning, he is sure to be confronted with a professor expounding the existentialist line that there is no God, everything is relative, and the only sin is to do something against his will. This philosophy, plus the continued message of the music and the overwhelming requirement for peer acceptance, makes it almost impossible to refuse a simple smoke from a friend. It creates a temptation that only the strongest individual can reject.